Here we are, and most importantly, Professor Spivak, who I think is one of the most thought-provoking intellectuals of our time, is actually with us. But before she will take the stage, allow me to say a few words about this conference. And as a matter of fact, it will be a little bit more than a few words. I will probably take 25 minutes to provide you with some kind of a background information as well as with the overall framework of this conference, and maybe also provide a few facts to those in the audience who don't have a background in American studies. Now, we all witnessed in this decade historic cataclysms such as 9/11, the collapse of the leading financial institutions, and the ongoing ecological disasters like the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. But this decade has not only been a decade of cataclysms, it has also been a decade of new beginnings. For the first time in history, a woman was elected Chancellor of Germany and an African American was elected as the 44th President of the United States. Communist China has emerged as the next world power, and post-apartheid South Africa is hosting the World Cup. When Obama was elected, okay, now, the visual component. I promise you that this will be a visual essay. When Obama was elected, U.S. media, from Huffington Post to Newsweek, hailed him as a transformative president. Obama himself reinforced this image through his campaign promises, his optimistic, "Yes, we can," alongside easy charm and striking intelligence, compounded his impression as a beacon of hope. Within a year of his victory, that mystique of change on which his candidacy was based had waned. Realpolitik has hampered this transformative presidency. However, the sociopolitical situation in the U.S. did indeed change, although not for the better. Unemployment and incarceration rates are on the rise, bankers salting away obscene bonuses, and the oil continues to spill in the Gulf. Unprecedented challenges mark the age of Obama. What then has been transformed? The fact that a black man became president is indeed historic. Many factors contributed to this victory. Some are the usual suspects. First, his brilliant rhetorical skills, grace, and his cool demeanor under pressure. Second, failures of the Bush era highlighted the problems of the Republican Party. Opposition to Bush grew considerably. Third, Obama's use of the new media during the election campaign, with his internet team sending out more than a billion emails and Twitters, also played a crucial role. No wonder the founder of the most popular political news website, Arianna Huffington, declared the winner of the 2008 election to be the internet. In the age of Facebook, people around the world have become more connected, as it were. There is a portion of the world at our fingertips that previously remained obscure and distanced. Even academic research and publishing has changed significantly. Back in the days when I was a student, we typed our term papers on mechanic typewriters and used a lot of whiteout or Tippex. Today, nearly every student in America owns a laptop and spends 4.5 hours online a day listening to podcasts, watching YouTube, tagging or emailing a friend. In 1998, only a handful of what were called weblogs existed. Now, a Google search on blog on Obama and race produces 23 million hits. Transformations in the media in the 21st century is, of course, a topic that intercepts with the theme of our conference. Now, the endeavor to theorize the interrelation between race and class is in many ways a typically American project. It's hardly translatable into German since the terms Rasse und Klasse immediately evoke the specters of anti-Semitism as well as communism. Given the legacy of slavery in the US, its long-standing racist traditions, the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement, race is and remains a sore spot in American history. Welcome. I'm glad you could make it. I just said race is a sore spot in American history. Do you agree? Okay. Now, given that context, Obama's election marks a watershed. It seemed as though America finally turned the page from its racist past. It's been widely proclaimed, and Obama himself has participated in this myth, that America has entered a post-racial era. In this view, Obama has led the American people to the promised land, leaving behind bigotry, discrimination, and racism. He became like a messiah or the Wizard of Oz who promised to take us over the rainbow to a post-racial, thus more perfect, union. Likewise, he presents himself as a paragon of the American dream. As he says again and again, in no other country on earth is my story even possible. The media, traditional and new, has portrayed his story as the triumph of American exceptionalism. Obama not only fulfilled what Lincoln began, he embodies the national myth of boundless opportunity in a land of equality and justice for all. Although he's intimately aware of the class and race-based obstacles to opportunity, writing openly about his personal battles in his memoirs, Obama nevertheless became the poster boy of this supposedly post-racist era. Obviously, America is far from having reached this promised land. Economic racism persists and even increases. The unemployment rate of Black Americans is twice as high as that of white Americans. While 10% of whites live below the poverty line, 25% of the Black population lives in poverty. Black and Latino population, I should add. And even rich Black men are subjected to racism or racial profiling, as we saw in last summer's widely broadcasted media event. Many of you know the story, but let me quickly summarize the Gates fiasco. The head of the African American Studies Department at Harvard University, Professor Henry Louis Gates, was arrested in his own house by a white policeman who believed, and he had some reason to do so, that Gates was breaking into that house. Charging Gates for unruly behavior, the officer handcuffed and took him to the police station. This way, a Black millionaire and renowned professor became a criminal. As the Chronicle of Higher Education put it, the Gates fiasco, quote, awoke the nation from its post-racial hangover. Even the ensuing beer summit, when Obama invited the Irish-American police officer and the African-American professor to reconcile over a glass of beer at the White House, didn't exactly bring about the end of racism in America. Now, for more details on this story, you're welcome to ask Professor Gates himself, who unfortunately couldn't be here with us in person because his daughter needs his full attention. However, he will conduct a live interview via Skype and thus be at least virtually present at this conference. But more meaningful than this hello. Come on in, quick. Find a seat. Okay. More meaningful than this unfortunate event, Professor Gates has made the news for that PBS documentary, Faces of America. Using the latest DNA technology, he provides 12 American celebrities with unexpected information about their ancestors, thus challenging and transforming their sense of identity. As he bridges the divide between the hard and the social sciences, Gates takes African American studies to a new level, and we will watch part of that documentary tomorrow. Now, looking at the first decade of the 21st century, I realized that the most recent dramas, the financial crisis and the oil spill, have nearly wiped out my memory of the Bush era. I think I'm not alone. None of the contributors to this conference decided to talk about him for some reason. Now, to cover that blind spot, I will present a 6-minute narrative following a strict timeline to provide a visual reminder of the political events that defined the first half of the decade. The most incisive event, of course, was 9/11. That day, the unimaginable became a reality. With the collapse of the towers of the World Trade Center and the attack of the Pentagon, two icons of military and economic power were destroyed. At Ground Zero, 3,000 people were buried in the ashes. This monstrous and highly telegenic event shocked and traumatized the nation. As a response to 9/11, Bush officially declared a war on terrorism. To protect itself against future attacks and to consolidate its internal strength, these fellows signed a treaty. Bush then cautioned against Iran, Iraq, and North Korea for helping terrorism and seeking weapons of mass destruction. His prime target, however, was the head of the Al-Qaeda. Now, Bush promised to capture bin Laden, dead or alive, and to smoke out and pursue evildoers, those barbaric people, end of quote. So this turns into a popular conference. You know, more and more people are coming. Back to Bush. His crusade against bin Laden included the prosecution, as you know, of regimes that allegedly harbored terrorists. Determined to pursue nations that provide aid or safe haven to terrorism, Bush urged that every nation had to make a clear decision. Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists. The unrelenting logic of the Bush Doctrine ultimately justified a so-called preemptive strike. In October 2001, Bush unilaterally, that is without the authorization of the UN, invaded Afghanistan. The military operation Enduring Freedom killed more than 1,000 Americans, 600 British, and 5,500 Afghani people, thereby causing twice as many casualties as 9/11. Now, America's domestic response to 9/11 was to devise potent strategies to reduce America's vulnerability to terrorism. In July 2002, Bush created the Department of Homeland Security. Employing a powerful rhetoric of fear, the 22 units of Homeland Security were eager to secure American borders. Airport security checks became tightened, demanding, as we all know, a ritual in which passengers take off their shoes and remove all shampoo bottles from their hand luggage. On March 20th, 2003, Bush and his friends decided to invade Iraq. The official justification for the war was, quote, to disarm Iraq of weapons of mass destruction, to end Saddam Hussein's support for terrorism, and to free the Iraqi people, end of quote. In a Senate meeting, Bush once talked about his motivation for going after Hussein, saying, after all, this is the guy who tried to kill my dad at one time. This operation, called Iraqi Freedom, cost the lives of 110,000 Iraqi soldiers and civilians, as well as that of 4,400 Americans, called casualties. And this image, when it was released, was commented by the Pentagon that the Pentagon was, quote, not happy with the release of the photos. Then there were these photos going around the world. And the government of the United States detained and, as it turned out, tortured alleged terrorists. The curtailing of basic democratic and human rights is also captured in this famous picture. America declared a state of emergency and acted accordingly, violating human rights and civil rights at will. No wonder that an increasing number of commentators began to voice objections towards the policies and practices of their government. Nevertheless, George Bush, and that's fitting, was re-elected in 2004. Now, a year later, catastrophe struck again. Hurricane Katrina hit the city of New Orleans. When the levees broke, about 80% of the city flooded, destroying the homes and neighborhoods of primarily poor African Americans. Given that the poverty rate in that area, the Ninth Ward, was at 30%, the observation by a local that Katrina ripped the mask off our poverty seems very fitting. The hurricane killed 1,800 people, 60,000 became homeless, and it caused a property damage of $81 billion. Although President Bush and the Army Corps and engineers had been forewarned that a hurricane of that magnitude would hit the coast, neither he nor the Department of Homeland Security was able to prevent the disaster. Now, looking back at Bush's two-term presidency on simply economic terms, this is how it stands. The defense budget doubled, coming up to $650 billion. The federal deficit reached its all-time high at $10.7 trillion. In other words, when Bush left the White House, he left a big tab. In September 2008, the Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy. The German bank Hypo Real Estate followed suit, and the banking system was on the verge of a major breakdown. Since I'm not an economist, I consulted, like any idiot, Wikipedia, where it says, in 2008 alone, Lehman stock had lost 73% of its value as a result of having held on to large positions in subprime when securitizing the underlying mortgages. Now, what does that mean? Most of you know what subprimes are, and most Germans, I assume, might not be familiar with the terms ninja, bailout, TARP, fat cat. So, are you ready? Subprimes? Stop in the name of love was a hit song by the Supremes. The subprimes, however, have nothing to do with love. During the boom years of the 1990s, mortgage brokers enticed by the lure of big commissions talked buyers with little income and poor credit into accepting housing mortgages with little or no down payment or credit check. Law professor Patricia Williams from Columbia University considers these predatory lending practices and calls the bankers criminals. To say the least, these loans were indeed subprime, suboptimal, as they triggered the ensuing mortgage meltdown. Another term for such a type of lending is ninja, which has nothing to do with Japanese warriors. It is the acronym for no income, no job, and no assets. In other words, these loans were given to borrowers who had no securities, and the lenders ignored the verification process normally required to make sure a borrower has a stable income in the interest of closing a deal. These high-risk securities were then traded on the stock market. In the case that a borrower, so the bank, was unable, the homeowner was unable to pay back his home mortgage loan, the lender, that is the bank, took possession of the house and sold it to recover the debt. If the house sold for less than the actual mortgage, the borrower may be required to pay the remaining balance, which meant he has lost his home, has to pay rent, and continue paying off his remaining debt to the bank. In that case, the banker steals homes, destroys families, and could thus be compared to a sword-wielding ninja warrior. I learned this. 1 out of 45 homes in the U.S. was officially foreclosed. The drop in real estate prices affected even those in the middle class who were able to keep their property. Those unable to do so, the lower middle class, even dropped into poverty. What seems funny in this picture can become very grim, as it involved many evictions, or, in the worst case, the ex-homeowners had to sell all their belongings and move into a tent, which led to the sprawl of tent cities all over the country. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, the number of poor Americans increased during the 2008-2009 recession by 2.5 million in just 1 year. Since this is only a number, and given that talking about poverty rates is very abstract, I want to introduce you to three individuals who are residents of a tent city near Los Angeles. Barbara, 42, here with a picture of her daughter. Below, Brad, a father of two, an ex-professional football player and ex-high school teacher. Next to me was Margaret, whose husband had just kicked her out of their apartment after she confronted him about sexually abusing their daughter. Margaret gets a disability check, she's an amputee, of about $880. Brad has Social Security and Medicare of about $750 total, and Barbara says she does not get any Social Security, so she has no income. Now, next term, bailout, has little to do with this. It denotes the sum that the government paid the bankers to rescue the economy. The bailout money has grown to the staggering amount of almost $900 billion, conceived of as loans to the bankers. So far, the banks have paid back only half of that amount. 700 out of those $900 billion are so-called TARP money. And TARP is an acronym that stands for Troubled Asset Relief Program. Excuse me. That's the next term. So that leads me to FATCAT, which is a slang word used to describe executives who earn what many believe to be unreasonably high salaries and bonuses. For example, this gentleman received $737 million in compensation, despite the fact that the company's net income shrank an average of 3% each year. Today, a CEO at Walmart earns 900 times the wages of his average employee. In 2005, the wealth of the Walmart's founder's family, a total of $90 billion, was estimated to equal the total wealth of the bottom 40% of the U.S. population. So 120 million people earned as much as their family. This is all to say that theorizing race and class is a necessary and timely affair. And that's why we're here. And over the next 3 days, we shall discuss various intersections of race and class and gender, starting tonight Professor Spivak shall elaborate on all these three categories of inequality and bring them to bear on literary texts. So, like any conference, this one would not be possible without helping hands and minds. And I want to thank my team and Andy, Angele, and Chris, where are you? Could you please stand up so in case you have questions over the next 3 days, they are in charge. Thank you very much. So, I've kept you waiting and in suspense. And now I will hand over to Dr. Miriam Nandi to introduce tonight's speaker. Miriam is the author of the 2009 monograph entitled Gayatri Chakravorty Spivak, eine interkulturelle Einführung.
Well, thank you, Sieglinde. When Professor Lemke asked me whether I could do the introduction for tonight's distinguished speaker, Professor Spivak, I was in awe. Not only is Professor Spivak one of the most influential intellectuals of our time, but she's also shaped my own work considerably. Like many young postcolonialists, I feel that I am forever in her debt. Gayatri Chakravorty Spivak was born in Calcutta, but she's been living in the United States for several decades now. She earned her doctorate at Cornell, went on to teach at the University of Iowa and Austin, Texas, and she's currently university professor and director of the Center for Comparative Literature at Columbia University in New York. It goes without saying that Professor Spivak has been fellow at some of the most renowned scholarly institutions in the world, such as the National Humanities Institute, the Davis Center for Historical Studies at Princeton, the Center for the Study of Social Sciences in Calcutta. Her worldwide activity as a lecturer has brought her to Cape Town, Osaka, Frankfurt, Graz, the Documenta in Kassel, the European Parliament at Strasbourg, to name but a few places. With widely received and highly acclaimed publications such as In Other Worlds, Outside in the Teaching Machine, Critique of Postcolonial Reason, she has defined and shaped the field of postcolonialism for the last 25 years. She has also had a strong impact on Marxist thought and on women's studies. Besides being one of today's most prominent cultural critics, Professor Spivak is also an award-winning translator in both the literary and the theoretical realms. She has translated Jacques Derrida's De la Grammatologie, as well as the work of the Bengali avant-garde writer Mahasweta Devi into English. Besides, she's also a social activist. Since 1986, she set up schools and trained local teachers in rural India. Therefore, her interest in race and class is not purely theoretical. Rather, her theorizing of race and class, to riff on the subtitle of this conference, is informed by a great degree of political sensitivity and determination. There is thus no other speaker who is better suited to inaugurate this conference than Professor Spivak. Her work, which has sometimes been characterized as Marxist, feminist, and deconstructionist, explores the intersections of race, class, and gender in a particularly challenging manner. I will take the liberty and relate an anecdote which may illustrate why Spivak's work is so pertinent for what we set out to do here. This will be a bit personal, for which I beg your indulgence. I grew up in a binational family in provincial southern Germany. My father is Indian, my mother is German, yet I grew up white, identified, well, I am white after all, feeling pretty much like your average German girl. I'm not even bilingual. I can say a nursery rhyme in Bengali, but my accent is appalling. In the early 90s, my hometown Laupheim earned sad fame when the neo-fascist party Die Republikaner received almost 20% in the provincial elections. So basically, when I was walking the streets, I thought every fifth person I'm passing by does not want us here. And then I suddenly felt very Indian, if you can feel Indian. Having said that, there is quite a different story that haunts our family memory. My father remembers how a group of refugees from today's Bangladesh were gathering in front of our grandparents' house begging for food. The family was at dinner, and the refugees were staring through the window, staring at the food the family was having. And I asked my father, how did you react? What did you do? And he said, grieving with guilt, we simply kept on eating. Thanks to Professor Spivak, we now have a language to address the problem that I have tried to outline here, namely that those who become targets of racism in the West may become complicit with the exploitation and the oppression of the subaltern classes in the South. To quote from Outside in the Teaching Machine, in our enthusiasm for migrant hybridity, third world urban radicalism, first world marginality, the subaltern is once again silent for us. It is important to note that Spivak does not say that focusing on migrant hybridity or first world marginality is wrong, nor does she say that we should look for something like maximum victimization, I'm quoting from an early interview here, as this would mean that the homeless in New York somehow suffer less than the people in the villages of Bangladesh. But what she is saying is that focusing on migrant identity may not be enough. The lesson Spivak teaches is that post-colonial theory risks eclipsing an understanding of global social injustice if it focuses exclusively on issues of identity. We have to learn to address race and class and gender at the same time. Thus, the challenge that Spivak Works represents here is that it constantly, persistently, looks for issues, themes, or figures that are missing within a theoretical framework. What has been missing in much post-colonial thought is an understanding and a concern for class issues. Conversely, Marxist analyses of class struggle often fail to take into account the gendering of the worker's body, which is even more complicated when we talk about female workers in the South. Spivak's usage of theory is both thoroughly political and extremely sophisticated. Like Derrida, who had a great impact on her work, Spivak pays close attention to the texts she reads, even when, or particularly when, she shows their shortcomings and crucial gaps. Professor Spivak, we are very grateful and very honored to have you here.
Thank you very much indeed. I'm very pleased and deeply honored to be inaugurating this important conference. I wish that I were giving, in fact, my media talk, which begins, Ramon, you've heard the first two sentences at Stanford, the only capital and data travel, everything else is damage control. But this is a different talk, okay? This is a literary talk, okay? Gender, Race, and Class, Three Women's Texts. I wrote something called Three Women's Texts and a Critique of Imperialism in the 80s. Actually, it happened in class in 1978 that I discovered suddenly that Jane Eyre was a different text. But that suffered from the problem of a sort of discovery, so that it's very clearly divided into the bad colonizers and the good colonized. It's a fault-finding kind of book, kind of essay, and I feel a bit embarrassed that it's my most anthologized essay. I feel that that's because it's easy to point a finger. I got much more complicated and therefore less interesting as the years went by. So once again, three women's texts. You have literature in the title, so I thought I would just read three novels with you. Post-colonialism, Black Gender and Ethnic Studies are largely identitarian subgroups within the general movement towards the sociology of knowledge started by the German ideology, gaining different faces as history changed and laws changed. This conference is interested in further reconceptualizations of class and race within that historical closure. I believe Culture Alive is its own irreducible counterexample, and quote, culture as an alibi is used by the ruling classes to block class mobility. I can say more on this in the Q&A. Into the question of race, following W.E.B. Du Bois and Antonio Gramsci, I have introduced class and subalternity. Fred Moten has recently interested me in Cedric Robinson and the expansion of the question of para-ontology into race. Since my literary readings will take time, this too I'm prepared to discuss in the Q&A if the spirit moves you. I would like to give some publicity to the problem of the Rohingyas and the children of Bhopal and how they illuminate the question of gender and the need to expand the question of race beyond identitarianism in the global context before I end. Let us assume for a moment that culture is a set of largely unacknowledged assumptions held by a loosely outlined group of people mapping negotiations between the sacred and the profane, and the relationship between the sexes, with sexual difference unevenly abstracted into gendering as the chief semiotic instrument of negotiation. A sign system needs difference, and when we want to talk about all the differences in a cultural system, the only immediately accessible one is sexual difference. So that's the semiosis. Culture, then, set of largely unacknowledged assumptions held by a loosely outlined group of people, mapping negotiations between the sacred and the profane, and the relationship between the sexes, with sexual difference unevenly abstracted into gendering, as the chief semiotic instrument of negotiation. Nationalism and religion come into play here. Gender, or something like it in all animate culture, the word is English after all, and the word is now more or less international, but I don't have the same attachment to the word as, let's say, from the other side, Joan Scott does. Gender, or something like it in all animate culture, is thus our first instrument of abstraction. Within this frame, we think reproductive heteronormativity, which I will affectionately call RHN, as offering immediately accessible content, seemingly by way of sexual difference. This is the narrow sense, the normal thing for not just human beings, but animal beings, seems to be for the male and female to copulate, to reproduce, and thus to continue life on Earth. Therefore, this is normal. It seems upstream from sexual preference. We are in a double bind with reproductive heteronormativity. Historically, both the normative coming of age, the young uprooting the old, especially young men, and of course, gender struggle, a more recent thing, feminism, queer resistance, are all in a double bind with reproductive heteronormativity. Sexual division of labor ceaselessly tries to manage this double bind so that decisions can be made, life go on. The phrase double bind comes from Gregory Bateson's Steps to an Ecology of the Mind, first published as a collection in 1972. Double bind can be generally described as follows. Contradictory instructions come to us at all times. We learn to listen to them. We learn to listen to them and remain in the game. When and as we decide to make decisions, and at every step we must make decisions, we know, therefore, that we have broken the double bind into a single bind, as it were, and that change will have to be undertaken soon, or things will change. Most of us do not learn this, and place both theory and practice in different ways in a seemingly permanent good and bad binary opposition. This is why that first Three Women's text is so popular. Nice pointing of fingers. They are bad, we are good. Most of us do not learn this and place both theory and practice in different ways in a seemingly permanent good and bad binary opposition. But the double bind shows that what is medicine becomes poison. The biggest double bind is RHN. For theory, I'll quote Derrida and Hegel and move on to the literary. Discussing Hegel, Derrida is already in the literary, the figurative. Derrida is identifying the family, RHN, as working figuratively in order to suppress a double bind in Hegel. I quote, "For now, this determinate moment of the family, this finiteness, figures." And Derrida has a parenthesis saying, "For now, I leave a very large opening for this word." The entry, I'm saying, the interruption of the literary. Very large opening. Figures the system's totality. For Derrida, the name of the double bind in Hegel is the Jew, because the Jew does not, in fact, just disappear as the evolutionary scale goes on. Unfortunately, the Jew is around. I continue with the quote. "When one rashly says that the finite family furnishes a metaphoric model," this is Derrida, "when one rashly says that the finite family furnishes a metaphoric model or a convenient figuration about the language of philosophical exposition, a pedagogical ease, a good way to speak of abstract things to the student while playing with the familiarity of family signification, even then, what the absolute familiarity of the signification is must be known." There's your RHN. Why is it that everybody knows it? That's Derrida's question. What is the absolute familiarity of something? Derrida goes on, "If that can be thought and named without the family, if it's only a heuristic metaphor, then one needs to ascertain that the finite family in question is not infinite already, in which case what the alleged metaphor would come to figure would be already in the metaphor." End of quote. What the alleged metaphor of the family would come to figure would be already in the metaphor. In other words, reproductive heteronormativity is the broadest and oldest institute for validation. It inhabits the most private, culture and nationalism, to the most public, citizenship and legitimacy. For centuries, for millennia, across the board, we are in a double bind with RHN. If we love our mothers, if we love our children, think Laura Bush, if we love our children, or if we queer ourselves in the gender struggle, we are in a double bind with RHN. I want to take it a step further into a more general sense. This is the narrow sense, right? This is the sense of empirical reproductivity and the family. I want to take it a step further into a more general sense, falling back always into gender. Friedrich Schiller proposed an aesthetic education to cure the epistemic violence of a nascent capitalism which he hardly recognized. His instrument was the Spieltrieb, the play drive. Bateson liked play training, but cautioned that it habitually failed with flag and sacrament, throne and altar. It is interesting that Freud mentions the same two items, throne and altar, in fetishism, as the monitors of fetishistic illogic. I would suggest that these are all coding ingredients at our disposal. Sexual difference and RHN are the irreducible. Those are all coding ingredients, but the irreducible are those two. Briefly, this is upstream, as I've said, from straight queer trans. Hetero here is the antonym of auto, not homo. Once you get into the general sense, the heteronormativity there is not about, it's not heterosexuality I'm talking about. Hetero there is the antonym of auto. For example, the queer use of childbearing is the extramoral use of this difference, the heteronormativity. So you here know Nietzsche's essay, thinking about truth and lie in an extramoral sense, right? This is hard. This is counterintuitive. I quote one of my Italian translators, the notion, she writes, of reproductive heteronormativity, which, as far as it seems, has never been translated into Italian yet, and which would sound, translated as it is, as eteronormatività riproduttiva, which is not particularly clear. I think it would be better riproduzione eteronormata, which would be closer to the idea of reproduction through traditional heterosexual intercourse. My response, sorry, reproductive heteronormativity does not mean reproduction through traditional heterosexual intercourse. The phrase is clumsy in English too. I hope you will preserve its awkwardness in Italian. In Q&As, I find people immediately fall into this sort of intuitive transformation of the word into heterosexuality and think that I'm talking about gay marriages and so on. No. Please preserve the counterintuitive edge here. Literature is not an illustration or example of theory or philosophy, and not unmediated evidence of an author's opinions or a culture. Let us for the moment say it is an instrument for teaching reading. In that spirit, I will read with you three women's texts that have tried to frame RHN beyond the simple familial content. Ama Atta Aidu, a Ghanaian writer, My Sister Killjoy, Colonialism, Anti-Racism, Homophobia, Mahasweta Devi, Statue, Nationalism, Love, The Caste System, Toni Morrison, Beloved, Slavery, Rape, Family. I will focus more on Mahasweta because both Aidu and Morrison write in English and the texts are immediately accessible to you, whereas the Mahasweta text is not, so you'll have to bear with me. Our Sister Killjoy first. Ama Atta Aidu's protagonist is not only a killjoy, but has a crossed eye. Her subtitle is, Or Reflections from a Black-Eyed Squint. The novel was published in 1977 at the remote inception of economic globalizing, what today we are calling a rupture in the 21st century. That rupture generally was introduced by the collapsing of the commercial banks and the investment banks. And when some of us talked about it, too abstract, not enough substance, not enough identity, and so on, but that's where we are as a result. But at any rate, so it was published in 1977, at the remote inception of economic globalizing, the controlling of the European recession by way of subcontracting and the silicon chip. But the book is written in the spirit of a critique of the first attempt in post-coloniality to establish an alternative to the North-South divide upon which today's globalization thrives. Except the division was East-West then. I'm referring, of course, to the first Bandung Conference of 1955, co-sponsored by Ghana and Indonesia. Aidu is from Ghana. She lives in Ghana and teaches there. She's just retired. When 29 Asian, African, and Latin American countries came together to create an economically non-aligned world. And the role of Africa in there, and you remember the extraordinary enthusiasm of people like Paul Robeson and Richard Wright and so on. This was a very strong moment. We can't even think of such a moment now. To create an economically non-aligned world. This was called the Third World. As it has been shown by Nigel Harrison and others, these plans died either at the meeting itself or very shortly thereafter, largely on the altar of nationalism. I do focuses on the hearts and minds shortfall of the spirit of Bandung, and I can speak for it. I graduated high school that year. India was one of the major players, so the children of a certain class growing into a location had a lot of fake international spirit. Once you got into anything serious, nationalism won. This marks the beginning of the market in international education. We were all called ambassadors. Today, it flourishes in the name of global contemporaneity. The metaphor has changed, but somehow if a class is full of foreign students, it's called a global class, God knows why. The novel is divided into four unequal sections. The protagonist is never named. There is considerable management of dramatic irony to frame the protagonist. In the section named as a citation from the book, as well as a citation from the protagonist, the section that is named from our sister Killjoy, this irony vanishes. In this section, I do breaks into wisdom songs that belong to regional African tradition. If we wish to describe this song by accessing as much anthropological material as possible, we will have forgotten Abiola Irele's important warning about varieties of radical discontinuity between tradition and modernity in contemporary African life. No, I believe I do falls into the wisdom song made simply to move into a textual voice other than that characterological voice, that is to say, the Madame de Stael and Goethe formula, character is destiny. I do taught until recently in the English department at the University of Ghana. There is a bit of a dig here at people like Pascal Casanova, who believe that everything begins with the German 18th century. The novel is talking about the recipients of the leftovers of imperial handouts. Postgraduate awards. This is how the wisdom song begins. Postgraduate awards, graduate awards. In other words, the UK or US, postgraduate or graduate. Did I hear you say, awards, awards, awards? I'm reminded of Kofi Anidoho, the Ghanaian poet who writes in both Ewe and English and is also a singer. He sings wisdom songs with his mother and also alone. He talks about how in the translation of the wisdom songs, invariably, the English translators are embarrassed by the repetition, and so quite often the repetition disappears. So watch out for the repetitions here. I won't read the whole thing, obviously. Did I hear you say awards, awards, awards? What a dainty name to describe this most merciless, most formalized, open, thorough spy system of all time, she writes. Columbia University is one of the national resource centers in the United States, established in the aftermath of the National Defense Education Act of 1952, leading the national resource part, leading to the establishment of area studies in the United States. And this, by the way, has not changed in the 21st century. Supposedly after 1989 it was going to, it fell back. And I'm not talking about how individuals are wonderful and there are real radicals within area studies. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the institutional stuff that Amma Atta Aidu is writing her wisdom song about. I continue. She writes, most merciless, most formalized, open, thorough spy system of all time. For a few pennies now and a doctoral degree later, tell us about your people, your history, your mind, your mind, your mind. Tell us, boy, how we can make you weak, weaker than you've already been, and don't you get any ideas either. No radical interpretative nonsense from you, flat nose. My brother, there should be no misunderstanding, no malice intended. Indeed, our dear academic doctors deserve all the worship they get from our poor administrators at home, and more. They work hard for their doctorates. They work too hard, giving away not only themselves, but all of us. The price is high, my brother. That's where, with a comma, the wisdom song ends, and then again the prose takes on. The story is as old as empire. That's the wisdom song. It goes back. It's not a It's not any improvement today. The story of our sister Killjoy, Sissy, begins as she is moving to study abroad within this context of the hearts and minds shortfall of the post-Bandung internationalism. Extremely pleased with the trip because she's never been outside and heliotropic time is defeated by the plane. I quote, "But just where and when the sun came to chase the moon away outside the window is not known. I remember this myself in 1961, coming from India into the United States. I was 19. That's the biggest shock of the sun and the moon out of the right window and the left window. It's a very peculiar thing. But just where and when the sun came to chase the moon away, our sister thought she heard the music of the spheres." This is Amma Atta Aidu. It's a really moving experience. But almost right after this comes the uncanny first experience of racism. Unlike Fanon's autobiographical account, this is not mediated by negritude, black skin, white masks. That's actually a kind of temporary playing around with negritude. Fanon clears out, one has to read the last section, chapter 7, section 7, to see how he does that. I quote, "From the little German that she had been advised to study for the trip, she knew that das schwarzes Mädchen meant black girl. The little girl says, ah, das schwarzes Mädchen. So she was somewhat puzzled. Black girl? Black girl? So she looked around her really well this time, and it hit her that all that crowd of people going and coming in all sorts of directions had the color, and then a very brutal phrase, of the little pig parts that used to come from foreign places to the markets at home. And she wanted to vomit. Then she was ashamed of her reaction. And then she wanted to vomit. For the rest of her life, she was to regret this moment when she was made to notice difference in human coloring. But what she also came to know was that someone somewhere would always see in any kind of difference an excuse to be mean." And then there's a little wisdom song, and I'll read just the end. "Power, child, power, for this is all anything is about. Power to decide who is to live, who is to die." Comma, the page ends. This young woman has two moments where she resists a German woman's desire to become friends with her. The German woman asks her, "What does Sissy mean?" And she gives the kind of descriptive half-lie explanation that I give when people ask me, "What is the dot about?" "It's a word for sister," she says. And then the woman asks, "But what is your name then?" And she says nothing. And then the woman, actually, we have been made to understand that the woman has fallen in love with her. There are long descriptions of how this happens, authorially sympathetic towards the German woman. The German woman tries to hug her and kiss her, and Sissy is just absolutely turned off. There is a moment of real horror at female homosexuality. I quote, "The room began to spin around her. Sissy knew that she had to stop herself from crying because before this she had felt that she was taking pleasure in being cruel to this woman. As the room began to spin around her, Sissy had to stop herself from crying. And so she describes to herself a white headmistress of a girls' school," I quote, "who turned into a panting tigress whose huge bosoms never suckled a cub. She gave first her youth, then the rest of her life, to educating and straightening out African girls. But one thing she could neither stand nor understand about them was that they never told the truth and they were always giggling. They say what broke her spirit was that one night on one of her regular nocturnal inspections, she found two girls in bed together." So she says again in a wisdom song, Sissy, to herself, "Is your mother Bush? No, miss. Is your father Bush? No, miss. Then why are you Bush?" Because the white woman, is trying to control this also by racism, thinking that female homosexuality is just lack of civilization, Bush. But a crime, a sin, S-O-D-O-M-Y, Sissy looked at the other woman and wished again that at least she was a boy. So this moment of horror at homosexuality, which related to RHN, is shown by Amma Atta Aidu to go across the race divide because Sissy feels completely turned off by it, as was the white headmistress. No amount of writing about Arab homosexuality or against the gay international, etc., is going to work here, like the anthropological entry into. We are not talking about anthropological difference in the understanding of sexual preference. This is in the historical present. Sissy feels completely turned off by it, as was the white headmistress. She controls it by making herself remember that a white woman had been turned off by it, thinking that it was African. An over-determined moment, asking to be unpeeled, literature as an instrument of reading. At the end of the story, there is another bit of action about her name. There, Sissy stages a Bandung-style rejection of a nice man she loves, an African man met in London, and she rejects him because he has decided to live in London. It's a class-marked boy meets girl, boy loves girl, girl loves boy, girl loves country more than boy story. The novel questions this story by way of the recognition of the trope of the proper name, not as story, but as text. This distinction between narrative, story, and textual rhetoric can also be Q&A material if needed. The story ends with a letter that Sissy is writing on the plane. There's much to comment on there, but the letter is never sent. It is never signed. The letter begins, "My precious something." And she describes why she's leaving him. But at the end, where the love gushes forth, she, Sissy, is telling us that what was most wonderful about this man for her was that after he had rescued her from speechifying in a general situation, he had asked her, "I know everyone calls you Sissy, but what is your name?" And that's where the book ends. Double bind. This question has been asked by two lovers, the white German woman to whom the reaction is staged in that peculiar way that goes across the racial divide, and this guy whom she loves, where nationalism divides. Now, The Statue by Mahashita Devi, also written in the 70s, and also hearkening back to an earlier period, the failure of decolonization after national liberation. The story is framed in the rural detail of the post-colonial nation. Here, literature strains to be evidence, but it is still through attempting normality that we train the imagination. Here is the opening paragraph, but we miss the tone, which is semi-official, perhaps no beans, if we read the details as evidence. I'm going to read it in English first, and then I'm going to read it in Bengali. English. The decision to raise a bronze statue of Dindayal Thakur, the freedom fighter, in Chatim village, and to dedicate, unveil it with enough pomp and circumstance, and soon, was taken at Calcutta Secretariat. The village is far from the madding crowd, situated, this is the kind of quote of English classics that the rural Bengalis will practice, situated in the outskirts of a state forest area. Soil type, laterite, low yielding. So this soil can't rear and raise a large farming population. The population of Chatim and seven similar villages is less than 3,000 all told. Government quota scheduled tribes, for example, Shantal, Munda, Bhumij, and similarly scheduled castes, for example, Bhuya, Hari, Muchi, Shuri, Bauri, this is the population. There are not 30 literate persons in the eight villages. The literate are as occupied with filling their bellies as the illiterate. Nobody takes or reads a newspaper. The nearest police station is 11 miles away. The district town is 7 miles away. There you have the necessary paraphernalia, such as a block development office, a post office, forest office, a social worker's training office, a school, the office of the sub-inspector of schools, a health center, a grain storage, or agricultural loan realization center, etc. For the tone, here is the Bengali. I will just describe the village rather than read it. Gramti far from the madding crowd. Sarkari jongol mahole na chole obosthito. Mati laterite kom pholna. Phole emati krishijibi janasankha beshi pushte palte pare na. Chatim ebong sadrisho satti gramer sakulle janasankha 3000 ero kom. Tapshili upojati jatha Shantal, Munda, Bhumij. এবং তপশিলি সম্প্রদায় যথা ভূঁইয়া হাড়ি মুচি সুঁড়ি বাউরি এরাই জনসংখ্যা আটটি গ্রামে স্বাক্ষর মানুষ সৃষ্টিও নেই যারা স্বাক্ষর তারাও নিরক্ষরদের মতো পেটের ধান্দায় ব্যস্ত কাগজ কেউ রাখে নাও পড়ে না। নিকটস্থ পুলিশ থানা মহকুমা শহর 7 মাইল দূর, সেখানে ব্লক ডেভেলপমেন্ট অফিস, পোস্ট অফিস, জঙ্গল অফিস, সোশ্যাল ওয়ার্কার ট্রেনিং অফিস, স্কুল, স্কুল সাব ইন্সপেক্টরের অফিস, হেলথ সেন্টার, ধানগোলা বা ধান্য ঋণ ফলপ্রসূ করার জন্য স্থাপিত সেন্টার ইত্যাদি প্রয়োজনীয় প্যারাফার্নেলিয়া আছে। দিস কাইন্ড অফ লিস্টিং ভয়েস, দিস কাইন্ড অফ সেমি অফিসিয়াল ভয়েস ইজ এ ভেরি কমন থিং দ্যাট ইউ হিয়ার অ্যাজ ইউ আর মুভিং ইন ইউ ওয়ার আই মুভ আন্ডার দ্য রেডার অফ দি এনজিওস টু ডিসক্রাইব, বিকজ ইউ নট জাস্ট কাইন্ড অফ দ্য গুগল স্টাফ ইজ নট হোয়াট ইউ ডুইং। Okay, a word on one of the generalized tones of the paragraph. It's probably Nobin's, a young rural nationalist activist male. He's undoubtedly a good guy, but his base is shaky. The statue is being built under the care of a man who is described in detail, the first named and fleshed character, I quote, for unknown reasons, and later we do find out what the reason is, graft. Since his grandfather had helped the British, there was no reason to think of him as a freedom fighter. For unknown reasons, the post-47 government figured, and look how Mahasheta describes independent India, post-47 government, figured Modon for a patriot and deluged him with license permits as a reward for his service to the nation. Licenses and permits for everything from liquor to bus service. Let us keep this in mind. Although the story is clearly about a character set apart from and by RHN, that frames national liberation within a broader validating context, it is national liberation that stages it. To echo Derrida, the family is part of a story that it contains. The woman appears later in the story and her history even later. I quote the passage where she appears. Sometimes she can be seen wandering in the dense, impenetrable jungle of the Thakur homestead. She can be seen means the python sees her. Although the dialogue with Nobin, end of quote, although the dialogue with Nobin, the good guy, who happens to be her nephew, appears just before this in the narrative, Mahasheta makes it clear that the character's constitution as object in the textual epistemology is as the object of animal gaze. She is seen means the python sees her. A reading lesson. In an extended study, I would ask if I can use here Derrida's peculiar word, animaux. For now, let me say she is of the animal's part and the goddess's part, for the snake is the familiar of the household goddess who was desecrated by her beauty and passivity, a tiny judgment where text and narrative come together. I cannot dwell on this here. Q&A. Let me quote a bit more. She looks unearthly then, thin frame, the winds of Choitro in her white hair, a rapt look in her eyes. That rapt look is seen often and Nobin worries. Pishi, aunt, has borne injustice all her life. Perhaps she is thinking of that, he thinks. In fact, she doesn't think of the past. She too believes in the present, as does Nobin. She thinks with dream-wrapped eyes, when she lies down at night, with the lentils seeded and wrapped in her cloth, how slowly she'll eat them in the dark. In fact, all her thoughts are belly-centered. When she dreams crude dreams. In her dream, she wears a whole cloth and eats a full serving of rice in a bell metal plate. Every day, only rice, no lentils, no vegetables, only rice. She is the source of Dindayal's martyrdom in 1924, the guy whose statue is being built, of the forced departure of the Thakur family, their feud with the Bhuiya family, the arousal of new interest in the subject of Dindayal in 1978, all. She doesn't recall this. Just as she doesn't recall that her name was Brojodul Ali, and once she was as different, diffident and blooming as a fully flowering, fragrant and white Kamini tree, end of quote. Kamini, the subject and object of karma, desire, a cautionary name for the female of the species, as also the name of a flowering tree, is now an object of the python's gaze. To end the quotation, no one wanted information from her, but she alone can recount the unwritten account behind Dindayal's martyrdom, the guy whose statue is going to be built. Narratively, she is here established as the authorial voice. She alone can tell the story. But textually, she's outside in the RHN machine. Unaccommodated woman, she cannot narrate. How does Mahershita manage? She uses indirect freestyle, but makes it clear that it is a self-separated account rather than memory, internalized memory. As in the case of can be seen means the python sees her, Mahershita is interested in teaching the reader how to read. I quote, suddenly she realized that she could not reach the mind, the love of those days, of the two she was thinking of anymore. At 78, the body becomes such that today's unappeased hunger appears much more real than the unrequited love of the past. It's impossible to become the Brojodulali of that time in the mind and to go back into the past. Possible rather to look at the Brojodulali and Dindayal of that time as another girl, another boy from a distance, end of quote. The reader is being asked to counter-focalize. The text urges the undoing of the rhetorical power of the indirect freestyle. Counterintuitive, but literature teaches by the experience of the impossible. It's like active forgetfulness. Don't think of elephants, that kind of stuff. You introduce the indirect freestyle and then you have to work against it, you, the reader. In an essay called Old Women, I have discussed Nietzsche's Baubo via his against the grain reading of Clement of Alexandria. The post-reproductive woman's genitals as an allegory of fearful wisdom. This species is not post-reproductive. She's outside in the RHN machine, a different wisdom. More on this when I publish the text. The story summarized is as follows. Brojodulali or Dulali was a very young widow from an unconsummated marriage, the groom dead on the wedding day, daughter of a landowner Bhuya caste family, of a caste that can sometimes enter the dynamic OBC or other backward class category in contemporary India up for political play. Dindayal or Dinu was Brahmin by caste, son of the local priest who is supported by this landowner. Dinu, very good looking, etc., is educated in the county town, falls in love and wants to marry this young widow. Of course, she herself has enough internalized ideology that she says, no, my God, it can't be, and says, you must marry someone else. His marriage is arranged. Part of the ceremony is held under a tree. She can't stop herself from looking from a distance. Their eyes meet. He tears off his wedding regalia and takes off. She's banished. She was going to be killed. It's a complicated story. Binu becomes a terrorist, a Bengali word, and is hanged by the British. The event itself is described as a combination of Dinu's ineptitude and the careless contempt for justice of the British authorities. Devi continues to be counterintuitive. She puts youthful libidinal choice, also known as, quote, love, and a national liberation followed by tremendous corruption as each other's ironic guarantee. I quote, two things are obvious from his recently discovered letter. Loving Dulali, Dindayal Thakur had faced some ferocious opposition from rural society, and he loved this woman. It seems as if unrequited love and participation in revolutionary activities were interdependent. The researcher becomes highly interested, end of quote. Not a python's gaze, but the researcher's. The description of research is contemptuous, but not exaggerated, I quote. I remember how we used to go to the India Office Library. Anything turns up, you can write a piece. I stopped very quickly. It seemed just not the thing to do. Anyway, she's describing research. The main motive force behind the renewed attention of the administration to the martyred Dindayal Thakur 54 years after his hanging was a bunch of mice and a light-hearted young jail clerk with too much time on his hands, and researchers' interest in preparing a summary of armed revolutionary struggles against the British in the 20th century. The object was to win a doctorate. A researcher went to write a doctoral thesis on the neglected events of the history of the armed struggles in Midnapur district. And he pored over jail records at the same time. His cousin, a jail clerk, discovered that mice were gnawing through a lot of 1920 to 24 records. At his cousin's request, he copied whatever he could rescue from those files. Mahershita shares this topos with Ama Atta Aidu, Farhad Mazahar, and others. Contempt for institutionally validated tertiary education that contradicts the corruption of a post-colonial present. There is an episode of the death of a young Ghanaian immigrant returning to Ghana because he had to hire a rashly driven car rather than drive himself and lose face in Aidu, coupled with racialized insurance policy, the white are not spared, coupled with racialized insurance policy in the metropole that would fit right in here. Such topological affinity is also world literature, although I care little for that name. Literature is not evidence. But since literature from Asia and Africa, even when hyphenated with the metropole, indeed most aggressively when thus hyphenated, is regularly read as evidence, even a shortcut to evidence, I offer a comment here. Mahasweta is not for imperialism and against the postcolonial. She is just not writing for the benevolent audience in the metropole, regularly legitimizing colonialism by reversal. This is both medicine and poison in globality. It is this ignorance of the metropole, recoded now as an ignorance of the global, that led her to be a major force in disabling the morally compromised Communist Party Marxist in our native West Bengal, rather than be an autocritical deconstructive force. If you want a message here, caught in its historical moment from the text, it is that even the good guys like Nobin, who reckon health, education and welfare over against the wanton greed in the post-colonial high rollers making money out of culturalism are caught with the bad guys in the double bind of RHN. The wise words in conclusion come from Pishi, Pitrishwasa, kinship inscription. The Pishi is the corrupt thing. Not Dulali, beloved child, diminutive of Brother Dulali. Outside, I repeat, in the RHN machine. I quote, "Suddenly, Pishi surprised him and said in a voice of tearless, dry pain, 'The flowers at his feet are already wilted, Nabin. Crows will shit on his head. Dirt will cover him. Haven't you seen the distress of the god at Manosha's open shrine all year round? The statue behind them stands in the same glory. It's not Dinu. It's a statue. Setting up, establishing, inauguration, subsequent neglect. A statue has nothing to do with this. Yet for the sake of a statue, a great disappointment can descend on the Nobins of this world. It has happened to this Nobin.' Nobin and Pishi keep walking in the dark." I would like to suggest that the double bind of RHN is at work here. Remember, a double bind is contradictory feelings, not just it's bad, but hey, I think it's good as well. That's the double bind. Room for Dinu is being made surreptitiously among the animals. Snake, mouse, crow, and the goddess. Nobin and Pishi are each other's sustainability, nephew, not son. A great deal to talk about here as well. Bhimraj Ramji Ambedkar was smart enough to suggest in 1916, still a graduate student, that it was only color prejudice, I quote, that made Western thinkers suggest that caste was related to race. Caste was related to race. Color prejudice in the thinkers, because they were themselves racist. That's Ambedkar's point. This is all the more astounding because Ambedkar was a Dalit himself and is now the originary inspiration of the Dalit movement in India and abroad. As you must know, he took on Gandhi, he wrote a lot of the stuff in the constitution. He then went towards Buddhism as a sign of secularism, ethics, and so on and so forth. So this was not a guy who had not suffered, but nonetheless, this is what he suggests. He saw caste as an enclosed class. Capitalism frees labor, remember, as an enclosed class, and sees its origin as indeed the origin of all group formation as superposition of endogamy over exogamy. This is Ambedkar. In other words, race using RHN to signify itself as race. Are you a citizen by birth or naturalization? That question. Literature is not evidence, but it is surely of interest as we teach statue in the classroom that we learn to read caste in this way. Written in the first abstracting power of gender, and that the guy saw this, and nobody's noticed it. I mean, the people are extremely enthusiastic about Ambedkar because he's this Dalit intellectual, worked with John Dewey. but no one's noticed this little thing. This guy writing about caste, and it's not like Engels, it's not a teleological story, it's not the origin of the family, it's an economy, it's at work. Very fantastic piece of writing. Literature is not evidence, but it is surely of interest as we teach statue in the classroom that we learn to read caste in this way. For in the end, this is how Dinu's father mourns as he leaves the service of the goddess, and I quote, "Am I still a Brahmin that I'll conduct a worship service? An untouchable hanged my Dinu." Not that he's dead. "An untouchable hanged my Dinu. An untouchable lit his corpse. Where is the Brahmin in me? You brought so much harm to me through your daughter." That's the thing. Endogamy and caste. Just a word on Beloved, for this is one book that you all know and should know. Chattel slavery undoes the possibility of heteronormativity in the narrow sense. To quote Hortense Spiller's brilliant title, Questioning Lacan Freud's Celebration of the Law of the Father, Mama's Baby, Papa's Maybe. By the way, Sophocles' Oedipus also questions the law of the father. That's another story. I'm not going to talk about it here, but it's gone unnoticed. Yes, as a longed-for agency of validation, RHN is even bigger than chattel slavery. It's scary. And Toni Morrison shows us men, slaves on the Sweet Home plantation, for whom the human claim to reproductive heteronormativity, in the narrow sense, has become unreal. I quote, "Sethi was 13 when she came to Sweet Home and already iron-eyed. The five Sweet Home men looked at the new girl and decided to let her be. They were young and so sick with the absence of women, they had taken to calves. Yet they let the iron-eyed girl be, so she could choose, in spite of the fact that each one would have beaten the others to mush to have her. It took her a year to choose, a year of yearning, when rape seemed the solitary gift of life." This is a rock-bottom sentence. "When rape seemed the solitary gift of life." It's like the pig part sentence in I Do. The brutality is brought out. It's no use trying to be polite here. Morrison surprises us further, I quote, "The restraint they had exercised possible only because they were Sweet Home men, the ones Mr. Garner bragged about, because they have been trained by the plantation owner not to rape." One is reminded of Buchi Emecheta in Rape of Shavi, rewriting Aeschylus's Agamemnon to make this point, the point that the stupid, venal modern European had taught her that clitoridectomy was an incorrect remedy as proposed by her mothers. It's a very overdetermined situation. Here in rape, there forbidding rape, same difference. Yeats left it a question at the end of Leda and the Swan. Did she put on his knowledge with his power? Leda raped by God. Who says women put on men's power when they're raped? The answer is yes, she did put on his knowledge, but because he's powerful and she's smart, not because he's good. And for Sethi, fully double-bound in RHN, such civility still belongs to its narrow sense, sex education enforced in slavery. And I use this word enforced here, you heard me give that aesthetic education talk, because of the impatience of human rights work, which now has turned much more to enforcement. If you look at Joseph Stiglitz's books as they go, the last book is all about enforcement, because it would take too long to, and it would have to be a very slow endeavor to really reach into these kinds of thickets where history has performed cognitive crimes. So therefore, this enforced sex education is, this civility is not enough for her. She will be made to deny that version of the hetero, narrow sense, sex education enforced in slavery. She will take on the autonormativity of the killer, bringing in what Fanon quotes very carefully from Hegel as he moves out of negritude. That last section is Fanon reading Hegel as the subject of the phenomenology, not as some kind of poor object. And people never quote it. People always quote the lived experience of being black, because, of course, that's much more interesting but Fana moves clear out of there. So the Shi will take on the autonormativity of the killer, bringing in what Fanon quotes carefully from Hegel as he moves out of negritude, and I quote, the possibility of the impossible. As I have argued elsewhere, no God stays her hand so that this can be coded as merely a sacrifice to establish genealogy. I quote, what it took to drag the teeth of that saw under the little chin, to feel the baby blood pump like oil in her hands, to hold her face so her head would stay on, to squeeze her so she could absorb the death spasms that shot through that adored body, plump and sweet with life. Beloved might leave before Sethe could make her realize that worse than that, far worse, was what baby Suggs died of, what Ella knew, what Stamp saw, and what made Paul D. tremble, that anybody white could take your whole self for anything that came to mind. Not just warp, kill, or maim you, but dirty you so bad you couldn't like yourself anymore. Can there be further development from here? No. Toni Morrison says, just weather, remember. Literature remains enclosed in its historical closure, but points toward readers to come, an instrument for change that weighs nothing. Now, this last bit I would not have been able to write if I had not been asked by a British publisher to write about the passages in the Grammatology that I liked to read most of all. And so I, after many, many years, I'm actually reading that whole book with modifying the translation with the French and the English side by side. And as I chose the passages, and there are favorite passages, most of them come, not all, from the first section of the book, writing before the letter, right? And there are two paragraphs. One is about reading, and one is about writing, okay? And the one that is about writing talks about this thing of the thought weighing nothing, because, of course, that is a textual blank which will move into the to come as the writing remains within, and these are Derrida's words, I've just read them, within the clôture historique, the historical closure. So it gave me a sense of being able to just lift it. There'll be a footnote, obviously. Just lift it. Literature is not an example of the philosophical. Literature is an experience of the impossible. And so, to an extent, this particular way of looking at it, that it points toward something to come while we produce movements that are unacknowledged productions of the sociology of knowledge movement that began in the middle of the 19th century, and we see it teleologically. The literary, which is a little bit boring when it's read, especially in a stand-up lecture, the literary, and not just confined to works of literature as such, remains enclosed in its historical closure while we think about teleology moving beyond rupture, but can point toward a to come which will not resemble us. The event escapes the performative conventions of politics, and that's where that thought that weighs nothing is lodged in the literary. So therefore, when we come to this passage in Morrison, we do not think about further developments. We remember that this will travel when we become simply an episode in how the sociology of knowledge movement moved. So I think I have used up exactly 48 minutes. I was told not to take more than 50, so I'm very proud of myself. And I have, however, marked for Q&A some points where I think I was not clear. I've also said that I would like to talk about the Rohingyas and Bhopal, but that's as it may be, because the Q&A is under your control, not mine. I just wanted to make my wishes felt, that's all. Thank you.
That one's gone or this one's gone?
So, the floor is open, and Gayatri made indeed many passing remarks to Q&A that I think that maybe a few questions have piled up. And there are microphones on either side, so Andreas and Angele will pass them on if you just raise your hand.
But this one's not be passed on.
No. Those are the two.
Do you want us to keep you company?
Sure.
Yeah?
Okay.
So, it's your turn. I didn't want to stand up anymore.
Oh, okay. Is that okay?
Yeah,
you
fine.
You can keep me company standing or sitting. Or anything like that.
Oh, thank you. This is mine now. You can hear me, yes?
You can have it, so you want to talk.
I'm just chairing the discussion.
Oh, you're chairing. I understand. You're just picking out people. Okay, fine. So go for it. This is, for me, the best moment. Even if you really dislike what I have said, it's still, instructive as to how you are disliking. Because there are some ways in which I'll stand behind what I did, right? So your dislike is not going to kill me. On the other hand, it may make me change. It does. So.
Now, I'm not sure if you mark this as a Q&A, but it is a very prominent motive in your talk anyway. Literature. Literature is not evidence. Literature is not philosophy. Literature is an instrument of change that weighs nothing. I was struck, amazed, fascinated by your slow, patient, dense, intense way of reading. Could you say a sentence or two more about literature as a medium? Could other cultural ways of expression, other media, be read just in the same way as you read literature? Or is there a strong statement about... is there a preference, even a predilection for literature as opposed to other forms of language?
How would you like to do this? Would you like me to answer questions one by one, or will you take collections? Okay. What a wonderful question that is. Wonderful question. I was taught to read by two extraordinary teachers, the Taruknath Sen, Presidency College in Calcutta, and Paul Dimon. And the funniest thing was that they were both, or perhaps because I was me, I read them as if they were similar, but they both insisted on being absolutely literal. It's a very hard thing to be. And then when I came across Derrida, as many of you know, I didn't know him when I bought De la Grammatologie of a catalogue. I met him about four years later. I found that he was almost obsessively literal. I mean, that was the power of his work, that he was just there, moving the stuff like a dog a bone. Now, as for literature not being evidence, evidence is not evidence. We need to make evidence because the law is just, but law is not justice. So therefore, if law were justice, or the enforcement of the law or a verdict were really justice, we would be in poor shape. So to an extent, evidence must be constructed in a way that denies the law of curvature that is communication. I mean, it is clear that I always notice at what point people leave, for example. And I try to, even as I'm reading with as much interpretative care as I can, I try to figure out, I read, why is this person leaving right now? What has happened up to here? Of course, sometimes I'm totally wrong, but it doesn't matter because most of the time I think I may be wrong. It doesn't matter. Literature learns from the singular and the unverifiable. So therefore, it seems to me that when Kant says that the things that you must assume in order to philosophize, you cannot produce evidentiary material that would pass in a court of law, and calls it the transcendental deduction, It's connected with what we are talking about here. I'm not going to go into my Kant phase, it's my hobby horse. But so, to an extent, the question of cultural reading, yes, I believe that this kind of work, the work of reading the world literally, is something that, I mean, yes, we are now in a historical moment where there are institutions of learning where the humanities are getting trashed and where speed is taking over this slow change of the rearrangement of desires, as it were. But if one actually creates a narrative of this sort, one would say that the teaching of literature and philosophy institutionally is young. So that, in a sense, that kind of teaching perhaps has always been outside the academic institution. Perhaps we are not getting kicked out for nothing. Perhaps it should, I'm not for it, obviously, I fight like a horse when it comes to protecting resources for the humanities, but that's a double bind in the long run. So I would say that this way of slow reading of cultural information, as it were, positive or negative, I think it's a skill that's older than institutional teaching of literature. And I quote always supposedly Christ's remark, he that hath ears to hear, let him hear. In other words, a person who knows how to read will be able to understand. I don't want to bring only material from other cultures. I'm a Europeanist. But so therefore, I would say that, yes, I hope I've answered your question somewhat. This is why it's so important for me to say it. By the way, I didn't say literature is not philosophy. I said literature is not an example of philosophical theories. That's what I said. So I think I'll stop there, because if I went on, I mean, your question can make me talk for a very long... Ramon knows. He knows. Because he and I went to the same school, as it were. Although we are not both Yalies. He's a Yalie, I'm from Cornell. But nonetheless, we share something here. I could go on forever, but let me stop. He had a question, actually.
So Gayatri, I thank you for this sumptuous feast. What a wonderful way to begin our discussions here for the next couple of days. As always, I find your comments deep and broad as well, taking it in both directions, so thank you. Well, after your comments at Stanford, I've been thinking a lot about many of the issues that you've raised here, obviously. As you said earlier, this connects with some of the things that you said a few weeks ago there, and in particular, your return to grammatology. I think that's not that you ever left it, but that you're rethinking of particular passages. Well, you may have been.
Really? Think of that. And I just thought that I was looking at it again last week. Yeah.
Well, so my question is sort of spinning from that cycle of thought. And so I'm taking your idea of the double bind, all right, as the place to begin. And the double bind clearly works as a heuristic. It works as a singular entity as a heuristic, because you have to begin somewhere from categories that you can isolate. But what happens, as I think must happen immediately, when you turn then to factors like gender, race, and class, where you're mixing concepts of very different qualities? And I take as a concrete example your turn from the wonderful South Asian text to the American text by Toni Morrison. So we've changed historical situations. We've changed categories of all sort. So my question is, I guess, stemming from that, what happens when double binds meet other double binds? When the double binds layer upon one another, do they complement? Do they contradict? Are they in dialectic? What is the relationship between those very different conceptual complexities?
Beautiful question again. I will say something that Mamadou Diouf, whom some of you know, wonderful Senegalese historian, I sometimes forget what his discipline is. He's so versatile. But anyway, Mamadou said this to me the other day. He said, you know, Gayatri, one of the reasons why one goes toward the postcolonial is because of the Venn diagrams. You know, and this, of course, he was speaking to me in shorthand because we were just talking to each other. I understood him immediately what he was saying. But that's the thing, isn't it? That it will be, you cannot, this is why I said that there is a world literature here, a topos, a trope shared by people. And I was very careful to distinguish the three historical closures and to say that literature remains within its historical closure but can point. It's so fantastic, you know, where one goes from that is that although sign, literature can be as trace, because the trace only points, it cannot make a meaning, right? So therefore, what you really have to do, and this I've written in my Rethinking Comparativism, Ramon, that's come out already in New Literary History, that when you, and this flies into these other areas, when you look at other kinds of struggles, instead of immediately making it over in the model of your struggle, you try to enter into it as if it too is a first language. Because what we cannot forget is that the history of these struggles through the gendering mechanism that I wrote about, it's not just gender in the sense of honor killings and how bad they are to women and not nice to women, gays, etc., etc. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about this gendering as abstraction. Each one of these, after all, in the group, shook up the metapsychological circuits so that ethical semiosis could begin. Not in you, going from the outside, right? So the model, it's not really just a model. The model of language learning there is incredibly important. The model of waiting, knowing how to wait so that something like that would travel over is incredibly important. That's why I was glad you looked at the slowness of it. On the other hand, when you are in a fight, you forget all of this. It's that the other side decides your single bind for you. The only thing to remember is, I mean, this is why I say culture is a culture alive. You know, when culture is being lived, it is mistaken for nature. You can't say this is my culture. But when the racist from the other side is killing you because of your culture, you got to say this is my culture. But knowing that it's only the other side that's provoking this grounding error, which is the ground of struggle. So those are two different kinds of answers. But I'll stop here because I think there are other questions afoot.
Thank you very much for this very interesting paper. I'm putting on my linguistic hat, and I was particularly fascinated by your reading the Bengali passage. And also with all these English words like center and so on, in it, and I'm not sure whether I caught this correctly, that you were saying that this is a particularly officialese kind of style by the narrator, and perhaps taking it from there, I was wondering, since you are looking at texts in such detail, and you have used the Bengali here as an example, to what extent does language participate in this double bind that you've been talking about? And maybe you can give some more examples from native languages of India.
Well, as I say, I don't really know many of the languages of India because I chose Europe as my object of investigation when I was an undergraduate. But I know Bengali, obviously, is my mother tongue. I read, write, and publish in it, but translate from it. I know Hindi well enough so that I can manage on the street. I can read it. And because I know a little Sanskrit, but that's a classical language, and the script is more or less the same, I can write Hindi. And I'll tell you a very funny thing about Hindi. I've been asked to act in a Hindi feature movie. Play more or less myself, and on the left, bohemian intellectual grandmother whose grandson is a stockbroker. So, you know, this is our life, right? The generation divide goes the wrong way, but it's in Hindi, right? So I'm going to have an audition on the 23rd. Luckily, my sister is married to a Hindi-speaking person, not a Bengali, so my nephew and niece living in Delhi are what we call half-bongs, and so their bong is a pejorative term for Bengalis. So they are good. They are Hindi speakers, and so I will perhaps speak better Hindi when I come next. If I pass the audition, the script I'll read well. My accent is not bad, but the guy wants to have a free-floating conversation, and I think that's going to lay me low. But at any rate, so I can't really quote a lot of regional Indian languages. No, I know Sanskrit well enough to be able to read non-philosophical Sanskrit, narrative Sanskrit without a dictionary, so that's a good thing. And so therefore that allows me to float about a little bit in the North Indian languages, but not that much. So yes, language, of course, language is the thing that gives us the double bind, doesn't it? Sometimes philosophers pick up on words that have the double bind in them. You know about it, you don't need Bengali. You know what word I'm thinking about, I hope you do. Diaufebung. That is supposed to be, Hegel writes about it in the Introduction to the Science of Logic, that common German has this wonderful word which goes both one way and another in a double bind. So the dialectic controls the double bind by making the Aufhebung too philosophical. But on the other hand, this is the best example that one can give to an extent. This sort of example, yes, also comes out of Bengali. It's not, it comes in Bengali, it comes in every language. But what I was trying to say about the tone and reading it in that way was not that it was official so much as a kind of semi-official language when they will speak to someone of the readership class, Mahashweta's readership class. They will often take the ones who are activists or low-level good officials. They will often take that kind of semi-official tone, because if they went back to the old sort of caste divides and so on, or class divide for that matter, it would not be possible for them, and they do not want to go into that hierarchical kind of setup. This is also true, and so as for the English words, well, of course there are English words. I mean, in English there are Norman words for the same kinds of reasons. These are loan words. They're also, if you had noticed, it's full of Arabic and sort of Saracenic Turkish words, because that's our jurisprudence. So to an extent, that's how language is. It takes in all kinds of things. In fact, when the Front Islamique du Salut won in Algeria in 1991, I was in the election booth so that I knew exactly what was happening. And before that, on TV, Abbasi Madani had a conversation with the socialist leaders, and the socialist leaders, of course, spoke the active Arabic of the street, full of French turns of phrase, whereas Abbasi Madani, sitting there, was speaking for He was speaking classical Arabic. And so that kind of undid the reality of the situation. So to an extent, the idea of the play of language as an instrument of the double bind works in so many different ways that it's this is why one needs to learn language deeply if one is going to enter the other enclosure. That's one of the requirements which we cannot fulfill. I'm glad you asked that question. There is nothing almost that goes. The trace stuff, you know, people will say music travels. you know, pictures, travel, etc. But in fact, they are transformed into something like permissible narratives in order to make meaning. La vérité en peinture, that thing in Coetzee where the woman is trying to teach Friday, the guy whose tongue has been cut off, how to write. And so she wants to, he doesn't know how to write, so she's trying to ask him, how was his tongue cut off? And so she's drawing these pictures, and then she says to herself, well, actually, it may look like someone is offering him a banana. No, it's an absurd moment, but Coetzee is making his point. So the kind of irreducibility of the verbal, as it were, is something that doesn't prove the superiority of language, but let us not think that the nonverbal is global. It's a deep and dire mistake. So, again.
I think we have time for one more question, but I don't see any hands up now. Chris?
Like I think everyone here, I love the things that you said about literature and the power of literature. But I'm also wondering about how to connect those powers up with what you were calling the sociology of knowledge or the unconscious reproduction of it in social movements. That really, I guess the part of this that is most pressing for me is how literary discourse connects with sociological discourses that have the power of representing the reality of many of the issues that literature also talks about. And I'm thinking in particular of the issues that came up in the introductory comments that immediately preceded you. And I guess my question is, would you be willing to think about how literature that stays inside the enclosure can also, and points into the future, can also do what Sieglinde and your introducer, whose name I don't know, I'm sorry, we're doing in theirs. That is, one talk was about the mass impoverization of much of the population of a wealthy nation. And the other presented a story about the interpolation of a racial subject through the threat of violence. And I mean, you know, these are stories that circulate in a sociological register. And I completely agree with what you were saying, and you know, I'm inspired, in fact, by what you were saying about literary sort of traces of those same kinds of stories. And yet I'm always wondering how literature can put itself onto a footing, the same footing with sociological discourses, such that it cannot be trashed in the way that it's being, and such that it can enrich our understanding of how these other forces circulate so that we aren't stuck in the way that we are with this regressive period that we're in. You know, how literature can actually move us forward out of that.
Do you have a solution? And I will take off from there. Because I obviously have thought about this long and deep, but let me hear what you think.
That's, well, I think that what you were saying about the believing in the reality of one's own experience of the impossible through the act of reading is a starting point for this. In other words, the experience of reading, the experience of seeing the intensity, the density, in some ways the superior reality of the experience over sociological forces, is a way that the reader has of believing in his or her own power to do something and to be part of the pointing towards the future. Not to sound like a bad English translation of Heidegger, but I am not as clear, aside from just the table pounding and the agitating that you do and that all of us do in the academy as humanists, clear about how to realize that in the context of scientific discourses and social scientific discourses, which are moving very much in the opposite direction towards quantification, metrics, audit culture, and so on.
My biggest allies are the non-quantitative social scientists, okay? Let me say with respect, I mean, I greatly enjoyed what Sieglinde and Mariam said, but I didn't think that that was sociology. I mean, those were sort of remarks about things that were non-disciplinary. I mean, you know, it's if you look at sociological material from within the discipline of sociology, it doesn't resemble that. So it seems to me that that's not the battle for literature to join. It's a good thing. It's a very enjoyable thing. We must hear that again and again. And I enjoy it too. But it seems to me that literature cannot become social science. And that's why I didn't say anything about, you know, when I was talking about literary instruction, I was talking about something else. It's epistemological performance. Imaginative training is a training for epistemological performance. It's like muscle memory. You know, if you want trained, this is very long term. And so it seems to me that if you want to engage with, I believe in sociology and the humanities being taught, you know, team taught, co-taught, etc. But I'm not the director of the institute anymore, but you said so, it's okay, people forget that I stepped down and Stathis Gouguris is the director now. But nonetheless, I was a founding member, maybe the founding member. Why? Because I wanted really sociology, not sociology so much, it's a defunct discipline now in the United States, but, you know, the social sciences and the humanities to be taught together. And my feeling was that we shouldn't shut up the methods courses. In the name of interdisciplinarity, everything else flew. But when it was the methods course for history, only the history people, when it's the methods course for this comparative literature and society, and now the new director is constantly telling me, I have to first let the majors enter, etc. I think that's not interesting. But that we are not talking institutionally like that. We are talking about the fact that what this kind of literary training does, this training the imagination for epistemological performance, is not going to ever win a competition with the way of doing social science where you can draw generalizations from a collection of facts. That they are not the same thing. It's the question is, I mean, this is why I said Du Bois and Gramsci, the question is, with what does the general folks, do the general folks work? And that's where this training might be able to transform epistemology. The epistemic, I mean, everybody is claiming that because we can instantly access things through the silicon chip, somehow we've had an epistemic transformation. No. It's the same old-fashioned research being done less well. Shelley wrote that we have to be able to imagine what we know, and that will happen around the corner later. Epistemic transformations you cannot, in fact, adjudicate. It's abreactive, nachträglich. But in epistemological performance, how do you construct what you know? That's the training of the imagination, and that is slow. And that happens through reading carefully texts of others, not just literature published as literature, in the disciplines, as I was trying to say. It's all over the place. So some people will read it that way, some people will not. It's, you know, many, many people go to the gym. They are not all going to win the World Cup. It's the thing, on the other hand, there is no other way of creating muscle memory. It's boring and it's slow. I talk about agents and subjects, right? When it comes to actually fighting for some short-term thing, then you don't think about this literary training. It kicks in. It kicks in. I mean, like when you do an instant replay of an athlete playing, this athlete is not thinking of all the moves that she's making. It's muscle memory that kicks in, and you see how it works. So to an extent, this is that kind of training. This is never going to, if it wants to compete with, you know, Ace the Historian or Ace the Social Scientist, I hope that American slang is accessible to everyone, it's going to lose. it's not going to happen. So therefore, I think, you know, the work that a Du Bois or a Gramsci encourages you to do is supplementing vanguardism, so that the vanguard must always be there to make change. I mean, even if it's not called a vanguard, we know that it is the people who get things done who always get the things to do, right? It's a small bunch who are always working because they're always getting things done. Everybody goes to them. Even if you don't call them a vanguard, they're a vanguard. Even if you say that it's all popular, etc., it's bullshit. It's actually, you know, people constantly show you videos to show how the people are really doing it. The moment you see that, you know that there's something wrong here. So on the other hand, all of this change is supposed to be for everyone, not just the vanguard. So how do you supplement those who will not be the activist, vanguardist, do-gooding, world-changing people? Don't they exist? And that's the thing that this kind of stuff, I mean, I'm giving a talk at the Freiburg Institute of Advanced Studies, inaugurating a fantastic conference, so I dressed it up, I did it properly, but you don't have to do it like this. You can actually do it in such a way that it will not be recognized as what is being done, and that's for everyone. That's for everyone. This is why Du Bois writes that right after the emancipation, I quote this all the time, I'm sorry I quoted that too, that the Negro needs food, clothing, and shelter, but at once and also to communicate with the stars. To communicate with the stars is not something that you do through the social sciences. Gramsci writes about the fact that it's not just changing from unskilled labor to skilled labor, but teaching in such a way that everybody can become a citizen and a leader. These kinds of approaches, these activist kinds of training of the imagination for long-term epistemological performance, that should not come forward to compete with the disciplines of sociology, history, political science, government, and so on and so forth. We can, if we want to learn how to fight them, we have to respect what we do a little bit more rather than be like them. Because if we want to be like them, we will lose. We are not. That's not what we do. So I can't say very much more at a one-shot deal here, especially since you didn't ask me for the things that I wanted to talk about. Come talk to me in other kinds of surroundings and you will see that I put my money where my mouth is. This is the struggle, to be able to recognize that who wins, loses. So that's where I think that's a good line on which to end, isn't it? So thank you again very much for your question.